This is WJBC This Week.
It would have a harmful effect on morale, and it would cost us lots of money, and we might very well lose, and so we're in much worse shape.
I'm not really terribly interested in becoming a legal test case on this.
Illinois State University is bucking statewide trends. This is just another symptom of that.
I don't think there'll ever be another Walt Disney in terms of loyalty. He loved the city of Wilmington.
What Sully did that day in saving 155 people certainly qualifies him as a hero.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, we'll talk with the attorney who successfully argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in support of legalizing gay marriage. An education policy advisor discusses the culture in schools and how to be better prepared for an act of violence. A Bloomington surgeon outlines the potential pitfalls of doctor's visits via video. We'll catch up with the former Redbird, who is now in the National Football League, James O'Shaughnessy of the Kansas City Chiefs, plus WJBC's Throwback Thursday interview with Ken Behrens. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in June of 2013 the Defense of Marriage Act, the law barring the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriage legalized by the states, is unconstitutional. Roberta Kaplan successfully argued for the legalization of gay marriage and later wrote the book Then Comes Marriage, United States versus Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. Kaplan talked with WJBC's Steve Fass this week.
Edith Windsor, your client, said that she approached other advocacy organizations to take on her case and was told that it was the wrong time for the movement. What made you think that it was the right time?
Well, part of it is history, a little bit of the history of what happened in the context of marriage equality. This law that we challenged in our case called DOMA was passed in 1996. In 1996, no state in the country allowed gay couples to marry, and there really wasn't even a prospect that any state in the country was going to allow gay couples to marry anytime soon. That didn't happen until 2003 in Massachusetts, and Edie Windsor, my client, didn't get married to her spouse until 2007. What happened is then when her spouse passed away, her spouse of over 40 years passed away, Edie's marriage, even though it was totally valid in New York, got treated by the federal government as if it had never existed, as if she'd never been married to Thea. And she had to pay a huge tax, over $300,000, as if she had inherited their property from a stranger. And so, you know, I thought that was the perfect way to challenge this injustice. We have a long history in this country of not liking to pay unfair taxes. I think, actually, if I recall my American history lessons from elementary school, I think our country actually started that way, having to do with some fighting in Boston. And so, in my view, every American would get in their gut, and hopefully the Justice Supreme Court would get in their gut, what it means to have to pay a huge tax simply because you're gay. And that's exactly what happened here.
You had argued for marriage equality before, in 2006, in New York State's highest court. Was there anything you took from that argument, from that case, which ended unsuccessfully for you, that you took into your strategy proceeding with Edie's lawsuit?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I lost the New York case, and I lost it big time. And I think it taught me a bunch of lessons. I think the first and most important lesson it taught me is that in order to win this case, this issue in the country, we had to make sure that the American people and the judges saw it as an issue about people and not as an issue about solely abstract principles. And so one of the things that had happened in many of the other cases, and there was good reason for doing this, but they've been brought on behalf of a bunch of couples at one time, four, five, six couples, so that you would have kind of the diversity of the community represented in the case. The problem that I realized when you had that, if you had six, seven couples, the couples faded into the background, and their lives faded into the background, and the cases looked more like a fight between Fox and MSNBC, pundits on Fox and MSNBC than a case about real people in their lives. So I was determined in the DOMA case to make it about Edie Windsor and her life, and I hope that we succeeded in doing so. I think we did.
You mentioned in your book that it didn't take you hardly any time at all to decide you wanted to take the case when you heard Edith Windsor's story. Could you tell us a little bit about the people, about Edie and Thea, and what made their life so uniquely suited to be the story you wanted to tell in court?
I mean, I could go on and on about this, but I'm going to try to tell you only one or two stories about their lives. So they first met in the early 60s in New York City. According to Edie, for her at least, it was love at first sight. I don't think she thinks that Thea felt the same way. But eventually they got together after a couple of years. And in 1967, I'm going to repeat that, 1967, when they were driving out to the country one weekend, Thea asked Edie if they were to get engaged, whether she could wear a diamond ring to her job at IBM. And Edie said, oh, I could never do that, because if I wore a diamond ring to work, everyone would say, who's the lucky guy? And I can't answer that question if it's you. I can't. And at those times, that was not a question I could ever answer. So Thea stopped the car, pulled over the road, got down on her knees, and pulled out a circular diamond pin that she gave to Edie and asked her to marry her. That's an incredible story for a lot of reasons, but probably the most incredible reason is that it was 1967. 1967 was 2 years before the Stonewall riots that led to the modern-day rights movement. The idea that two women in 1967, it would even occur to them to get engaged, is incredible. And then, for the next 40 years, that's the truly heroic part of the story, because about 10 or so years into their relationship, Thea was diagnosed with a terrible form of multiple sclerosis, and over time, she became completely paralyzed. And Edie made sure that as little in their lives changed as possible, so that, in fact, on the day that Thea died, she was a psychologist. She actually had patients that she was seeing that day. And so if you think about it to yourself, God forbid, no one knows in life what's going to happen. No one knows, God forbid, they could get a terrible diagnosis like Thea got from her doctor about the multiple sclerosis. But the one thing that I think we all know is if, God forbid, that ever happens to us, we sure want to have a spouse like Edie Windsor by our side. So I thought that that story, the years they lived together, the dedication, a marriage that was truly in sickness and in health till death did them part, I thought that was a story that every American would be able to understand.
We're talking with Roberta Kaplan. She argued successfully in the Supreme Court case United States versus Windsor, which struck down a key provision of the Defense of Marriage Act. And she has written about that in her book, Then Comes Marriage. You mentioned the practice that Thea had. And one of the things that you write about in your book, which really wasn't part of the story when this was covered in the news, when this case was one that you successfully argued in the Supreme Court, is you actually had an interesting personal connection to Edie Windsor, really actually before you even met her. This is an interesting story. It's a little bit remarkable that you connected with your client after you had had a history with her and with her wife.
Yeah, it's actually truly an incredible story. So in 2009, when I got the call after Thea had died from Edie asking me to represent her, I knew exactly who she was, but I had never met her before, but I knew she was. And the reason that I knew she was is because of almost 20 years before that, when I was a third-year law student, and it had been my bad luck that my parents came to visit me at the very end of my third year, and it turns out it was Gay Pride Weekend in New York City. And as they were kind of wending their way to my apartment through the Gay Pride Parade, by the time they got to my studio apartment, they were in fine form. And they started talking about how they couldn't understand why anyone would be proud to be gay, and what are all these people doing out waving rainbow-colored flags, et cetera, et cetera. I said to them, you know, please stop. Don't talk about this. And they persisted. And ultimately they said to me, are you gay? I said, yes. And then my mom proceeded to walk over to the corner of the apartment and start hitting her head against the wall. The reason I tell the story is not to criticize my parents. My parents have apologized for this thousands and thousands of times by now, and they fully embrace me and my family and couldn't be prouder of me. But during that summer, as a result, as you can imagine, I was kind of down. And I started asking around for a psychologist who understood gay issues, which is the way you talked about it back then. And the name I was given was Thea. Believe it or not, Edie's spouse. So I actually saw her spouse as a patient two times only in the very same living room that I met Edie in years later, because he already at that point was completely paralyzed. And during our sessions, here's the probably the most incredible part of it. During our sessions, Thea actually talked about Edie. I think, looking back on it, that Thea was persuaded that the only way she would be able to convince me that it was possible for me at that point in time to have a lifelong commitment, to have a family, to have the kind of relationship I wanted, was to talk about Edie. So that's, believe it or not, I knew who Edie Windsor was, and we had a connection even before I represented her. And when I got the call, I remember thinking to myself, God gave me this opportunity as a way to pay Thea back.
That was attorney Roberta Kaplan with Steve Fast. It's been 3 years since a student at Normal Community High School attempted to hold a classroom hostage with a gun before he was tackled by a teacher and a potential tragedy was thwarted. But school violence remains ever present in the news. Cleet Buellock is an education policy writer and author of the book Creating a Culture for High-Performing Schools. He discusses school violence in the context of that incident at NCHS as he talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
What do you think, you know, when the teacher has to step in like that and someone so young, 14 years old, being involved in a school shooting?
Well, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book is because of, I call it the existing culture of control in our schools today. When something goes wrong in a school, the students wait for an administrator or a teacher to correct it. There are very few students who will step in and take control of the situation. The same is true with the shooter. They stand around and do nothing. Just like, you know, waiting to get shot. If a shooter walks into a classroom with 30 kids and the 30 kids took action like they did on that plane on September 11th, 2001. Mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania, yeah.
You know, they could overpower the shooter. But the culture of control is let the administration or the teachers step in and do it.
Did you see the video? Oh, go ahead.
Luckily, in the situation you talked about, there was a teacher there who did step in. The school that I describe in the book that we've written is, how do you give control to the students so they will step in? When it comes to bullying behavior, they'll all gather around and watch the bully. And some of them will even join the bully against the victim. In the school that I describe, it is okay for students to intervene. It is not only okay, they're supposed to. So in a given classroom, when a student isn't doing what they're supposed to do with the process that I've put in place, the other kids are going to correct the kid.
So that's okay for the other kids to jump in?
Huh?
It's okay for the other kids to jump in then?
Right. You've not only made it okay, you have told them, I want you to do that.
But isn't that putting their life at risk?
No, because let's put it this way. In a gang, do kids control each other?
I'm sure there's a leader. Yeah.
Absolutely. All members of the gang control all other members of the gang. So, and if you look at ROTC programs in high schools, the kids control each other. They're supposed to. There's a hierarchy in there, and they control each other. So kids can control each other. As a matter of fact, they know how to do it. If you think that isn't true, imagine the parents listening out there. If your kid's in the wrong peer group, who's going to control your kid, you or the peer group?
Yeah, it's going to be the friends.
Yeah, their friends have more control over them than parents do.
What do you think about the suggestion that we should arm teachers?
Wow, that's a loaded gun.
Absolutely, absolutely.
No,
but it's
no
been suggested.
Intended.
It's been
no
as a real
intended.
Suggestion, yeah.
I would, if I were a superintendent today and there were a danger of a shooter in my schools, I would find out who on the faculty knew how to use a gun, who wanted to carry a gun, and I would have a procedure in place so that only those people who, you know, were really qualified had a gun. Then the second thing I would have to do is find out where that gun is going to be stored. Is it going to be on the teacher's hip, in their pocket? Well, I don't think that would be a good idea, because these kids are pretty sharp. If you can pick a pocket, you can pick a gun.
And they're strong.
There would have to be a way to keep a gun in a secure location.
Well,
so that would mean that in every classroom, if a teacher had one, there'd have to be something locked.
That was education author Cleet Bulach with Terry James. There's been a recent push in the healthcare industry to make medical professionals more accessible to the patients they treat. Video chatting could make it easier to get an expert opinion on an ailment, but a Bloomington surgeon says there are drawbacks to seeing a doctor remotely. Dr. John Whelan talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
I am seeing organizations now, larger medical organizations, offering this as an option to promote, you know, a different kind of health care.
Right. So it speaks to several different aspects of care. So it speaks to access. If there's limited access, it improves access. It's immediacy in terms of having direct contact, not waiting in the waiting room, not being screened by any number of staff people. But it also has some potential pitfalls. I mean, if you're doing it as part of a concierge medical practice, I think that those physicians already have relationships with their patients. If you're just calling in, if it's just an 800 number and you're calling in, you're really talking to a stranger. And so even though you can look at that person, you can listen to them, you can get a quick feel for them, there still is really, I have to take the hard line and say there's no substitute for placing hands on a patient because some things need to be felt. Tumors don't just present themselves. Symptoms can overlap quite a bit, and so many disease processes many diagnoses are arrived at through a combination of obtaining that history from the patient and not just a visual inspection but a physical exam.
I am surprised that doctors and larger healthcare organizations would be willing to take on what I see as added liability if something goes wrong after a Skype consult and something was misdiagnosed because of what you're talking about.
Well, you could look at it that way, but also I think that if there's a fairly rigid set of agreed-upon guidelines for simple and basic things, illnesses, and I'm sure that every one of those visits, especially from larger health organizations, comes with the disclaimer that if the patient or the person is not improved within a defined period of time, that they should seek face-to-face evaluation from a health professional, or that these are opinions only, or this advice shouldn't be construed as medical treatment. I don't know how.
So
you
patients
would, how
are
you
basically waiving their right to sue if they don't do enough.
You never waive your right to sue, but I mean,
well, you can always sue for anything. But I'm saying successfully sue.
I think they should be informed. I think that those health systems need to have full disclosure to say, you know, this is one option that you're pursuing, but we have other more thorough options, and there's no testing by a Skype. You can't order a blood test. You can't do an X-ray or something like that. Not to say that that's always necessary, but it's certainly in our armamentarium to be able to do that for diagnostic purposes.
It's a step above a phone call to the doctor.
Yeah.
Well, and I have to admit that I've had mostly family members and friends.
Oh,
but,
of course.
But if they say, I've got this thing, and I said, okay, take a picture of it and text it to me.
We're going to do a show. I got this thing.
Yeah. So I've done it. And but those are family members, and if they better not threaten to sue me.
But in some cases, you know, my kid has pink eye.
Yeah,
I think,
I mean,
put the kid in front of the camera and
right.
say,
"You're absolutely right."
This looks like pink eye. Is
so
that what it is?
Some of those, yeah, and so so some of the detractors from this telemedicine industry say, well, it's going to lead to overprescription of medications, antibiotics specifically, and
we're already there.
So there are some detractors from the technology, but I think it's advancing, and I think it's only going to become more prevalent. And so I think we need to work hard to improve it. If it's not going to go away, let's try to figure out what types of encounters fit that treatment the best, and then go forward with that, and then make sure that everybody is aware that, you know, if it's something that needs to be touched or needs to be imaged in some way, it's not going to be possible over the phone.
I could hold the phone up to my mouth, open up, and does that work? I'm doing it to the doctor right
yeah,
now. Do I need a light?
That's
Disgusting.
Yeah, do you remember the Clutch Cargo cartoons? Because
yes,
that's what your mouth looked like right there.
Clutch Cargo with his pal Spinner and Paddlefoot. This is something
I think
that's
it's a good
not
thing.
Gonna go away.
It's not going to go away. The technology is only going to get better. But I think that we need to spend a lot of energy on the qualifications.
Up with a list of like 25 ailments.
Yeah,
that
what fits
would
the best.
Qualify when, for a Skype session.
Right. When the nurse practitioners open minute clinics as a step or an evolution from even urgent care. There was a lot of trepidation about that, but there's a really strict set of guidelines that they follow, and there's physician oversight to those encounters, even though it's remote. And so what was originally greatly feared has become a real good answer to specific type of patient encounters.
That was a Bloomington doctor, John Wieland, with Scott and Colleen. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Three members of last year's national runner-up Illinois State football team are now playing on Sundays in the National Football League. Cameron Meredith of the Chicago Bears and Mike Lidke and James O'Shaughnessy of the Kansas City Chiefs. The three actually played on the same field for a game in KC 2 weeks ago. WJBC's Austin Duncan talked with the tight end O'Shaughnessy this week.
Has the NFL been what you've expected to this point in your career?
For the most part, yes. As in, expected the heavy workload, expected the grind, you could say, of every week, it being an extremely important game, just like college, but it's just amped up a little bit more. So for the most part, I would say I expected what it was like, but there was also some things that were surprising that you had to get used to, but overall, I've had a great experience for this first 6 weeks.
And what was the biggest surprise, would you say?
It's a difficult thing to describe, to tell you the truth. Until you get to an NFL facility and work with an NFL team and get used to the type of professionalism they handle everything they do with, whether it be practicing, meetings, along with having fun and, you know, reminding yourself that it's still a game that you love. So there's a fine line you have to kind of teeter in between the two. That is something you kind of have to get used to. Besides that, nothing too strenuous, nothing too difficult. Like I said, I've had a blast these first 6 weeks.
We're talking to James O'Shaughnessy, former Illinois State tight end, current Kansas City Chiefs tight end. You know, you just talked about having some fun, and I know a lot of times rookies get nicknames from their veteran teammates. Any do you care to share?
Well, to tell the truth, Shag is still alive and running. I kind of get that nickname every once in a while still, but sad to say, my nickname around here is Babyface. So,
oh.
I've been called Babyface by almost everybody on the team now, and it seems like it's sticking.
So can I make a guess who set that one out there? I'm going to go maybe your mentor a little bit, Travis Kelce.
Yeah, he's one of the main culprits in spreading it, but he's got a bunch of nicknames. He's a funny guy, so he's always cracking jokes.
And how is it learning behind, you know, a seasoned vet like Travis Kelce?
It's great. Not only is he a talented tight end, which anybody's ever watched him can tell, athletically he's extremely gifted, but he's actually extremely knowledgeable of the game. So that's been the biggest thing he's helped me out with. Obviously, coming from a Division I AA and playing at the level I did, you learn a lot, and I mean, I'm more prepared than most. Coach Beck did a great job for that, but learning the NFL game, learning the NFL defenses, he's really helped me along with that.
And what were you feeling when you came out of the tunnel for your first game, let it be at home or away?
Well, the first away game was fun. I was to get a good against the Texans, so going through the tunnel, I was jacked. But the best game was obviously the first home game against Denver on Thursday night. Running through the tunnel, that one was just it was exhilarating. It's a difficult thing to describe, and just you got a mixed bag of emotions of excitement and being a fan of the game, and but then also remembering that you got a job to do, you got to stay focused. So the first home game really blew me away. That was unbelievable.
So you bring up that game against the Houston Texans. Did you get the opportunity to go against probably one of the best defensive players in the game in J.J. Watt?
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't get too many chances to go against him. I think I only had one or two blocks against him. I would have liked to get a couple more just to really feel him out, but obviously he's a great player. And he had a good game against us. We were fortunate to pull off the win, but I was happy with the things I did against him when I got a chance to go up against him.
Talking to James O'Shaughnessy from the Kansas City Chiefs, tight end, former Illinois State Redbird. Drafted by the Kansas City Chief in the fifth round, did you hear from any other teams on draft day opposed to Kansas City?
Yeah. So the truth is about three or four that I knew were very interested, Kansas City being one of them, along with Panthers, Eagles, a couple other ones that were in need of a pass-catching tight end. So, tell the truth, draft day, I had no clue I was going to end up with Chief. Obviously, I'm extremely happy that I did. Perfect system for a tight end like me. But draft day was a stressful couple of days, and I'm glad it all worked out the way it did.
And you have gotten a rare opportunity this year. You got to play against your former teammate and current Chicago Bear, Cameron Meredith. What was it like playing against the old friend?
Awesome. Tell the truth, I was jacked for that game. Not only being a lifelong Bears fan to get the opportunity to play them, but to play Cam was awesome. Obviously, he played unbelievable. The two catches he had at the end of the game were crucial catches that sealed the deal for them, won them the game. So I give a lot of credit to him. I'm extremely happy for him. I just kind of wish he didn't do it against us. But you know what? Hey, I got to give a lot of support to the man. He's working hard, and he's doing great. I'm excited to see how he continues this, because I know he's going to get a lot of opportunities throughout the rest of the season.
Was there any smack talk leading up to that game or maybe a little bit after?
Oh, yeah. game day, we were pretty civil. We talked before the game, said a little something, but nothing too bad. But all week leading up to it, I'd catch a jab every once in a while when I come home, check my phone. I get a nice little text from Cam. But it was all good fun. I told you, me and Cam have known each other forever, worked out together before the pre-draft process, so to get a chance to be on the same field against him was an amazing time for me. I couldn't be more excited for both of us.
That was former Redbird James O'Shaughnessy of the Kansas City Chiefs with Austin Duncan. And Ken Behrens was a midday staple on WJBC for decades. He stopped back for a visit with Terry James in our WJBC Throwback Thursday interview.
What years were you here at the radio station?
I was here from 1970 to 2002.
So just a short-time, part-time job that you were doing here.
Yeah. Well, it started out part-time, actually. I did almost everything you could think of as an announcer. I did everything but sports, actually. I was farm director when I first came on, but I also did some news work and was chief announcer eventually later on, production work. I was production director at one time, did market reports, rotating basis on Saturday. Generally, I was on from 9 a.m. till 1 o'clock weekdays, and then would work Saturdays too.
So you didn't have to get up too early?
Not real early. Well, actually, when I started, I was on before Munson. He had me do the sign-on thing.
Oh, okay.
And we started out with Reverend Zier, who opened up in the morning with a prayer and a little 15-minute devotional thing. And
I wonder if Lachlan still prays before he goes on.
Well, he should.
Maybe to himself, yeah. He does that sort of thing. Ken, you got that one of those voices, though. I was calling your home to get you set up for this, and I thought, is he doing his radio voice on the answering machine? But it's just the way you
not
speak.
Not really. I try not to do it. But, eventually, I think actually, Jerry Van Dyke told me, he said, no matter what you're doing, you may as well be you, because eventually you're going to have a day when you don't feel like faking it. So the more natural you can be, the better.
Absolutely. You know, listening to you on our 90th anniversary show that we had you on, you had so many recorded guests You had them record something, I think, when they were guests on your show.
Oh, intros to the show.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you get that done? I mean, did everybody agree to it?
Nobody ever said no. And it was just one of those things I thought. It would be kind of a nice little thing to drop in. Gave them a little extra publicity. But that was the thing. When I started actually doing the show from 9 till 1, and the noon hour actually became Paul Harvey and other news, but I engineered it. So page 3 always meant a new commercial had to be plugged in during the Paul Harvey show. But from 9 till noon, basically, I was doing a one-person show, and I would produce it and host it and engineer it and have to line up all the people. And since I was in there alone, I really relied a lot on phones. Mm-hmm. And you probably know this too. The days that you walk in there with a really prepared show, you may get a call from somebody that just steers the show in a different direction.
Oh, yeah. All your prep's gone for the day. Yeah.
But if you go in there unprepared thinking something will happen, it'll just flow by itself, nothing happens. So,
I've experienced that, Ken. So what did you do on those days?
So I arranged – well, I tried to have various interviews set up. And I did a lot of celebrity interviews, a lot of author interviews. And I would always love it when we could get people in the studio. And we were fortunate enough to get people like McLean Stevenson, Barry Williams of the Brady Bunch. I was in some plays out of Conklin's. It's funny how this whole radio thing opened up other doors for me. I wound up doing some plays. I did about a half a dozen plays out at Conklin's Barntew Dinner Theater, which unfortunately is closed at this
Isn't that
point.
A shame, yeah.
Although I guess they're going to do one Christmas show coming up.
Out in Washington.
Right.
Or what I heard, yeah.
Right. But anyway, that was a great opportunity. And then Chaunce talked me into doing some stand-up, and I was house MC in Peoria at the Madison Avenue Theater for about 2.5 years. And that's when I got to work with people like Drew Carey before he made it big and some other folks. And so that opened up a door. And consequently, I got to do some other things. I got to do the Playboy Club, the Saber Room in Chicago, the Palmer House in Chicago doing stand-up. And then I worked with a guy that I had on from Peoria, Royce Elliott, who was a stand-up comedian. And he opened exclusively for Conway Twitty and Barbara Mandrell and the Gatlin Brothers. And sometimes he would do shows on his own, and I would open for him. And we did the normal theater. When I left the station, and this was really one of those things that really made me realize how much I love the community and how much they embraced the station and the people who were on it, got a call from the Normal Theater, and they said, we'd like to do an evening with Ken Behrens. Mm-hmm. And so I did a whole evening out there, and they had a big band that came and started the show. And then I did probably too much. I did probably close to an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours.
It's like a Bob Hope appearance over there, right?
But it was great fun, and it was a sellout, and the Normal Theater made some money with it, and it was a great fundraiser. But we had times where McLean Stevenson, passed away, and we did a tribute to him at the Normal Theater. So there were other things besides just being in the studio, doing a radio show that opened things up.
You mentioned you were here until 2002. From people I've been interviewing over the past several months, it seems like there was a real turning point in the radio station right there in the early 2000s. A change in staff. We switched over and got rid of all the music altogether.
Yeah.
Munson had left. A real turning point in the radio station.
Right. Actually, we sort of weeded out the music gradually. And I would say for the last 7 or 8 years that I was here, I guess we didn't play really any music at all other than to fill. Mm-hmm. And you could rely on that. In my case, while I'm busy on the phone trying to get a hold of an interview, I'd have a record on or something for a short time. And then it would turn into talk. And eventually we were all talk.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be the route for most AM stations at that time. But I have nothing but fond memories of being here and feeling very privileged to have been a part of WJBC's history.
It's a family sort of thing, isn't it? I mean, with the listeners and with your coworkers.
Right.
When you step into that studio, you just it's family time.
Yeah. I just talked with Denny Atkins, who did more on WBNQ than JBC. But we brought back a lot of memories and visited with a couple of the engineers. Well, Bob Wilcox, mm-hmm. who was a salesman. He's still in town. And Larry Scholl, who's one of the engineers who was here. And so there's still some people around that we get together with and visit with. Brandon DeVogel not too long ago. And Steve. And it's great fun. Steve wrote a book, turned out to be a New York Times bestseller, Reasonable Doubt. That was all about the Hendrix murders.
Big-selling book.
And so I felt like I had to do something, and I submitted a joke to Reader's Digest and got published. Which I actually didn't really do it because of Vogel's book, but because Vogel had a book signing, I had a joke signing. And while he had his out at the mall at Barnes & Noble or someplace, I set up a card table out in the front here. We had people bring their copies of Reader's Digest out so I could autograph the joke. Oddly enough, they republished that joke. They put it in with their best of book collection, and so it was kind of fun to watch it grow.
Before the internet, before anybody could put anything they wanted online, so that must have been a pretty good joke. Do you remember it?
Well, it was kind of a timely joke, and I'm surprised they kept it. But the joke went as if an older lady was taking up skydiving.
Uh-huh.
And she took all these lessons in course. And then finally it was her time to go up in the plane. And she's flying over the target. And they said, okay, get ready. And she didn't jump. And they flew back over again and said, all right, get ready, jump. And she still didn't jump. And this went over several times. And finally she radioed her instructor on the ground. And she said, help, I've gotten up and I can't get down.
I like it. I like it a lot. That's very good.
That was former WJBC host Ken Behrens with Terry James. The Weekend News is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. A benefit for Bloomington City employees hired before 2012, allowing them to cash out unused sick days prior to retirement, won't be changed for now. WJBC's Joe Ragusa says the council has decided to tell city staff to keep researching the ramifications of any change.
Mayor Terry Renner says the city doesn't want to be in a position to set a legal precedent over the change in benefits.
We're not exposing ourselves to anything. We're not really committing to something where we might be in court.
Springfield is currently involved in a lawsuit over a change in its vacation day buyback program, similar to what Bloomington was considering with its sick leave buyback program. Any change would have only impacted about 250 Bloomington employees hired before the benefit was eliminated for new hires. Employees have used the benefit to raise their average salary and consequently their pension payouts. Since 2012, municipalities have had to pay accelerated payments to cover the costs of spiked pensions. Bloomington has paid $1.3 million to the IMRF, while Springfield has paid $3.5 million. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
One of Bloomington's longest-serving public officials has died. Walt Bittner served on the city council for 44 years, including 8 years as mayor. Bittner died on Wednesday at age 97. Former Mayor Rich Buchanan, who appointed Bittner back onto the council, recalls one incident where a woman called the mayor's office to complain the snow plows kept plowing in her driveway.
He grabbed a shovel and drove over. Waited for the plow to come by a third time and scooped her driveway.
Buchanan says Bittner never did things like that for show. Illinois State University has been spared from having its credit rating downgraded by Moody's Investor Service, a claim six other public universities cannot make. ISU Chief of Staff Jay Groves says there are a variety of reasons why Moody's decided to affirm the university's A3 rating.
We have set enrollment records for the last 2 years in a row, breaking 25 and then 26-year-old records. Our applications for next fall are coming in very strong. We have low bond indebtedness, strong and stable enrollment.
The University of Illinois was the only other public university in the state to keep its credit rating. Moody says the outlook for every university in Illinois is negative because of the state budget impasse and the uncertainty surrounding potential cuts to higher education. Initial projections from the governor's office were to cut higher ed 30%. Illinois has gone 4 months without a budget. Congressman Darren LaHood says he's glad to see Congress pass a budget, but he's not happy with how it happened and what's inside.
One of the things that I ran on is we got to figure out how we reverse that trend. And this adds to, we're close to $19 trillion in debt now. And that was the biggest thing for me was increasing the debt without getting spending under control.
LaHood voted against the two-year budget deal, which eases spending caps by providing $80 billion more for military and domestic programs paid for with the spending cuts and revenue increases, touching areas from tax compliance to spectrum auctions. The Senate passed the deal in the early morning hours Friday. LaHood says he didn't like the deal was cut behind closed doors. A legal expert predicts former House Speaker Dennis Hastert won't have to serve time behind bars after his guilty plea in a hush money case. Ann Lucene, a constitutional law professor at John Marshall Law School in Chicago.
I think very likely he will get no prison sentence and he will get a lot of community service, maybe house arrest. but what would be the purpose in giving him a prison sentence?
Lucien says it's clear Hastert's career as a lobbyist and his reputation are destroyed. Hastert will be sentenced in February. And the man behind the Miracle on the Hudson in 2009 is coming to the Marriott in Uptown Normal next spring for the Red Cross of the Heartland Evening of Stars. Event co-chair Steve Deneau says Captain Chelsea Sully Sullenberger saved the lives of everyone aboard U.S. Airways Flight 1549 when he guided the plane safely onto the Hudson River.
What Sully did that day in saving 155 people certainly qualifies him as a hero.
The Red Cross is hoping to raise $200,000 with the event next year. Lynn Haruska with the Red Cross says the money will stay in the community.
Every single day in our community, someone is experiencing the worst disaster of their life. American Red Cross volunteers are there to help them cope with that disaster and put their lives back together.
Tickets are on sale now for the April 21st event and can be purchased by calling 662-0500 or visiting redcross.org/IL/Bloomington. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It's time to take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Governor Bruce Rauner will come to Bloomington for a town hall meeting at the BCPA as Illinois enters its fifth month without a state budget. On Wednesday, the local American Civil Liberties Union chapter will host a forum on the use of police force entitled Myths and Policy Considerations. That'll be at the Normal Public Library. On Thursday, the Economic Development Council of Bloomington Normal will host its Community Leaders Dinner featuring former Pittsburgh Mayor Tom Murphy. On Friday, Illinois Wesleyan will open an exhibit of a painter's self-portraits revealing the devastation of Alzheimer's disease. Plus Sunday, runners will step off at Heartland Community College for the annual Jingle Bell Run to benefit the Arthritis Foundation. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Starr.